On tonight's Arena, we hear the best of Sean Rock's interviews with screenwriters, including Wim Wenders, Ava DuVernay and Viggo Mortensen. First, though, Cord Jefferson discusses his Oscar-winning film, American Fiction.
You're listening to Arena's Olympiad with me, Sean Rocks, the best of Irish radio arts to keep you company during the Olympic Games. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Questions of who is allowed to make what art arise with hilarious and thought-provoking outcomes in the feature film American Fiction. It stars Jeffrey Wright as the academic and writer Thelonious Monk Ellison, whose very literary novels, adapting Greek myths for the present day, have failed to make the bestseller lists. Facing criticism that his work isn't, quote, black enough, Monk writes a hoax novel under the alias Stag R. Lee, which, to put it mildly, leans into ghetto stereotypes. The book, however, becomes a commercial success, and Monk finds himself having to embrace his literary alter ego in a very real way. Along with all of this, Monk is facing challenges closer to home with his elderly mother and his wayward brother. After working as a journalist at Gawker and later as a writer on hit shows like Watchmen, Masters of None and Succession, writer and debut director Cord Jefferson adapted the script for American Fiction from the 2001 novel Erasure by Percival Everett. The film has been nominated for no less than 5 Oscars. Before we hear from director Cord Jefferson about American Fiction, let's hear a clip from the film. Here we find our curmudgeonly hero, Thelonious Monk Ellison, played by Jeffrey Wright, in a large bookstore.
Excuse me, Ned, do you have any books by the writer Thelonious Ellison?
Yeah, this way. Here you go.
Right. Yeah. Wait a minute. Why are these books here?
I'm not sure. I would imagine that this author, Ellison, is black.
That's me. Ellison.
Yeah.
He is me, and he and I are black.
Oh, bingo.
No bingo, Ned. These books have nothing to do with African-American studies. They're just literature. The blackest thing about this one is the ink.
I don't decide what sections the books go in, and no one here does. That's how chain stores work.
Right. Ned, you don't make the rules.
This all started, I think, Cord, when you read Percival Everett's novel, Erasure. When was that, and how did that come about?
That was December of 2020. I was reading it with no auspices. I just was looking for something new to read over Christmas break. And I found this novel, Erasure. I read a synopsis of it. I'd found it while reading a review for a different book, and I decided, you know, it sounded interesting, and I went and picked it up and just fell in love with it instantly. I'd never encountered a piece of art that resonated with me deeper before or since.
That's a big statement to say, no piece of art before or since that resonated so deeply. Why? How did it resonate so deeply with you?
Well, the novel, there's a lot of satirical themes about the lead character Monk's professional life, mostly being about what it means to be a black writer and sort of the restrictions that people put on the stories that black writers can tell, particularly the idea that black writers are and the best black stories are about black trauma, about slavery, about inner city poverty, about gang violence, about drug addiction. All of these things that we sort of know to be kind of the common themes of stories in African-American cinema. And Monk is frustrated by that. And I was frustrated by that as a TV writer myself. And then beyond that, there's a lot of family stuff as well. Monk has 2 siblings, for instance. I have 2 siblings. We have a push and pull relationship the way that Monk does with his siblings in the book. Monk's mother is ailing from Alzheimer's. My mother didn't die of Alzheimer's, but my mother did die of cancer 8 years ago. And like Monk in the book, I moved home toward the end of my life to help take care of her. My father is very similar to the father in the novel. I love him very much, but he is overbearing. I think he'd admit that he's overbearing. And so just the overlap between the character Monk and sort of his life started to, you know, it started to become eerie almost how much his life resembled my life. And it felt like by the time that I was 100 pages into the book, I knew that I wanted to try to adapt it into a film.
It is quite extraordinary that something could resonate at both a professional and personal level so much as you've just described, Cord. And in fact, that's the way the film rolls, as the novel does as well. It has both those professional and personal sides to Monk's story. Sticking with the professional side of things for the time being, you mentioned there that you had come across this kind of limiting presumption around what you might write in television, in film, and I think in journalism as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I was a journalist for about 8 or 9 years before I started working in film and TV. And toward the end of my journalism career, I published this article called The Racism Beat. It was an essay about how almost on a weekly basis, somebody was coming to me and saying, do you want to write about this black teenager murdered by the police, or this black teenager murdered by the police, or this black teenager murdered by the police? And it felt like, oh, my job was just a revolving door of misery at that point. It felt like it's spiritually eroding to just cover that all the time. And B, it felt like, what can I write about this that I didn't write about the week before when this happened, or the week before when that happened, or that other people hadn't written about for decades or centuries? It just felt like, is this really all that people want out of the story of the black experience in America? And so when I started working in film and TV in 2014, I was excited because it finally felt like, great, we're not beholden to any realities. We're not beholden to telling true stories. We can get into anything we want to get into. And it wasn't long before people were coming to me and saying, do you want to write a movie about a black teenager being killed by the police? Do you want to write a movie about gang members? Do you want to write a movie about somebody dealing crack in the inner city? And it felt like, oh, even here, even in the world of fiction and fantasy, where we can write about anything we want to write about, there's still an incredibly limited perspective as to what black life looks like. And that, you know, 3 months before I found the novel Erasure, I received a piece of feedback from an executive about a script I'd written in which they told me that they wanted me to make a character blacker. That note came through an emissary, of course, because they were afraid to tell me that themselves. And I told the emissary, I will indulge that note if the person who gave it to you is willing to sit across from me and tell me what it means to be blacker, explain to me how to make a character blacker, and I will consider making that character blacker. And of course, that note went away because I think the person knew they were going to commit a civil rights violation if they actually went through with that meeting with me. And so, you know, this was just it was something that sort of came in to me in various capacities and various iterations, but there was always the implication was always that there is a black life is not as complex and nuanced as everybody else's life, and that the stories that we want to hear about black people do not have the same depth and nuance and breadth and variety as other people's lives. And that to me was obviously painful as a creative and annoying as a creative, but also just as somebody who watches film and television and reads books. That is a frustrating reality.
One of the things that I really love about American fiction in that respect, it's dealing with this character of Monk, who is writing these wonderfully worthy Greek mythology books of Greek mythology, great works of art, not making him a lot of money, not making his agent a lot of money, and not many publishers jumping up and down to buy them. We see him in that situation. But the way that you treat, and I guess this comes from Percival Everett's novel as well, the way that you treat the complexities around the presentation of quote-unquote black stories is so satirical and so comical. How important was it to you that it didn't become po-faced in any way?
Incredibly important. I think that, you know, to me, firstly, race is, to me, always ripe for comedy, because race has this incredible absurdity in which that it is both real and not real, right? So if you talk to the vast majority of scientists will tell you that there's no basis for race in biology. That's sort of this idea that we are different people because of the color of our skin is absurd, and that in fact we are far more alike than we are dissimilar. And so on the one hand, race is not real and insignificant. And yet on the other hand, we've created our institutions and our countries and our societies with the idea that it is real, right? So on the one hand, race is not real, but racism is real. And so to me, that inherent tension and that absurdity of something both real and not real and both important and incredibly, both unimportant and incredibly important, you know, that to me is a perfect subject for comedy. And so I felt like it's anytime you talk about race, it has to be funny because race itself is absurd and funny. And so I don't think you can talk about it without being funny. Secondly, I think that something that sort of that I feel like so many Irish artists that I really like have also understand the idea that if you lose the ability to laugh, that's when you really lost everything. And then sort of like that you need to find ways to find joy in the misery. And in fact, it would be a disservice to people who have really gone through the tortures of the past to not acknowledge that they were also having fun and laughing and finding ways to celebrate. And so it's also important to me to just remind people that, yes, despite the difficulties, despite racism, despite all the problems that are inherent with that, you have to find ways to laugh and have fun. And you know, that's what makes life worth living.
You're helped along enormously by the casting of Jeffrey Wright as Monk, as the main protagonist, and indeed Sterling K. Brown as his brother. And there are other great comic turns within the film as well. I often wonder about how much fun is it on set when you're shooting a comedy, or how serious a business, to go back to that old cliche, is the making of a comedy script and a comedy film.
It's so fun. I mean, everybody took it seriously. Everybody was there because they were passionate about the material. But you know, from the first day that we were on set, it was as if everybody was family. We this was a movie with a limited budget, a limited timeline, so we never had time for rehearsals. We were just sort of like went in and did it every day. But fortunately, the rapport that the actors had with each other, the rapport that the actors had with everybody on set, was made it a delight to go to work every day. And something that Jeffrey, you know, I'd never directed anything before I directed this film, and so I didn't have anything to compare it to. But something that Jeffrey said that really stuck out to me, that I think of a lot, was Jeffrey said that he said that when you go to a film set, you can tell how much people care about the project based on how they work. And so he said that you go there and sort of the grips and the carpenters and everything, they work a little faster. They work with smiles on their faces. They sort of like when you need it to be silent, everybody's actually silent and sort of like is respectful of that. And so he said that he could see very early on that people were working on something that they were passionate about, that they knew was going to be good. And so that was something that he picked up on early that I had no idea about. I just knew that, having never directed anything before, I thought, well, why am I not more afraid to go to set every day? Why am I not sort of like sitting in my car, sick to my stomach and terrified and panicked about going in there? And I think that sort of one of the reasons why I wasn't is because it was just a very healthy environment to come to work every day, and everybody was very grateful and gracious. And yeah, it was the delight of my life.
I need to touch on the family issue as well, if we can, Cord, because that aspect of the story is nothing, may I suggest, to do with race. It has nothing to do with colour. This is the experience of many people across many cultures. Talked about the push and pull of the siblings, and also the ailing mother. And my sympathies on the death of your mother. In this case, we're dealing with a mother who has Alzheimer's, as you say. That kind of family, those family tensions, doesn't matter where you are, who you are, that's a universal story.
Exactly. And that to me is one of the things that has made me so delighted about the reception to the film. It's been, you know, we've shown the movie all over the world at this point. We've shown it to predominantly black audiences, to predominantly white audiences. We've shown it to older people, to younger people. We've shown it in France. We've shown it in the UK now. Like, the movie has sort of traveled. And the thing that's been nice to see is that every kind of person at this point has come out of the theater and told me that they found something that they resonated with and that sort of spoke to them. And I think that's because that family stuff really helps ground the movie, even if you can't relate to Monk's professional struggles, even though I think that's pretty universal, the idea that everybody wants the freedom to be who they are, and that sort of what the crazy things that people will do when they feel they aren't given the freedom to be who they are. But even if you don't sort of feel that speaks to you, most people are born into families, and most people understand what it's like to have a family. And so that has been sort of a touchstone that I think has really worked to make this story one that resonates with a lot of different kinds of people, which has made me happy.
Cord Jefferson, thank you so much for speaking with us on Arena. Congratulations, by the way, on the Oscar nominations. Good luck
thank
with
you
Best
so much.
Picture and Best Screenplay. Kind of good luck to Jeffrey Wright, but we are kind of rooting for Cillian Murphy. You'll forgive us if we do that.
That's fair. Cillian's a wonderful actor. I'm very happy for him. But thank you so much for speaking with me.
Isabel Wilkerson's groundbreaking book, Caste, The Origin of Our Discontents, explored ideas of race and how it has been manipulated to create social hierarchies all over the world. The book so fascinated director Ava DuVernay that she simply had to make a film about it. DuVernay is well placed to make a film about race, given her past works include the Oscar-nominated Selma, about Martin Luther King and the civil rights movement, and 13th, a film about race inequality in the US prison system. I spoke to director Ava DuVernay earlier today about her film Origin, which is based on Isabel Wilkerson's experiences, both personal and professional, as she wrote the seminal work Caste. She's played by Ingenue Ellis-Taylor, and the film follows the author as she travels to Germany, India and the United States and researches social hierarchies and how they powerfully use caste systems as a means of oppression. However, not everyone Isabel meets in her travels agrees with her thesis, as we hear in this exchange at a dinner party where Sabine, played by Connie Nielsen, and other guests push back on Isabel's drawing equivalence between slavery and the Holocaust.
Well, there are so many differences between here and there. We're talking about the systematic murder of 6 million Jews. That's the official number. So it's just very different than monuments to soldiers and whatnot.
What are you saying is different?
All of it. We're talking about deliberate extermination over many years.
Yeah, but wasn't slavery for like hundreds of years, right, Isabel?
Slavery lasted 246 years. That's 13 generations of people, plus another 100 years of Jim Crow, segregation, violence, and murder.
It is, of course, horrific. I am not downplaying any of it.
There were so many millions of African Americans who were murdered from the Middle Passage until the end of legal segregation that it goes beyond the realm of an official number. There is no number.
I didn't know that.
Oh, stunning.
It is, and I understand you're trying to make sense of American racism. It is noble. But your thesis linking caste in Germany with the United States is flawed.
It's an extraordinary book. It's an extraordinary set of ideas. I'm guessing that's what attracted you to it. But was there something specific that spoke to you in the book, Ava?
Well, thank you for having me. Happy to be with you tonight. I think what spoke to me in the book was a way to organize my own thoughts. When the book came out, this was the summer of 2020. We were in the middle of, the beginning of the pandemic. And also it was the summer that a man named George Floyd was murdered in the United States. It had a great effect on me and many people around the world. And so to read the book, it felt like an anchoring, a way to organize my thoughts about myself, my place in the world, and really to get thinking about the structures and the systems that bind us to certain ways of being biased towards one another. And so the book helped me quite a bit.
When I heard, in lots of ways, the book covers all kinds of cultural and social theories and sociological theories, philosophical theories and history within it. The thought that might make a feature film didn't jump out at me immediately.
Yeah, well, I don't think it jumped out to many people. But you know what? The thing that it was less about, wow, this is a film, and more about, I want people to know this. I want people to know this who won't read the book. I feel like this was such a a turning point in my understanding of things. And I hold a degree in African American studies from university. I make movies about this stuff. I'm a student of it. And yet, these ideas helped me give shape to the notion of race in a new way. You know, really what Cass says is it is the foundation that all of the isms sit on top of. Racism, sexism, classism, homophobia, Islamophobia, anti-Semitism, all of them sit on top of caste. Caste is the undergirding. It's the base. It's the part that says I'm better than you based on a set of random traits that you can't control. Where you were born, you know, what your family's religion is, you know, who you love, what color you are. These things start to govern us, and that governing is really what caste is. And so to say that race is made up of caste, that caste is a part of race, really gave me a new way to articulate my primary identification. And that's what the film invites folks to do, is to look at yourself in a new way.
I suppose if we speak about some of the specific examples of caste that you give us in the film and which come from the book itself, it might explain how caste can transcend class. It can even transcend race in many ways. It's a kind of a random grouping, as you say. Tell me a little bit about the Dalit people in India.
Yeah, so the Dalit people, widely known as the Untouchables, it's what they'd been called for many decades and generations, are folks that are considered not even a caste. They're below the lowest caste. These are folks who are relegated to an existence that is historically meant to not only serve, but to really be invisible, to not be a part of society. And so the Dalit people had a great leader, a great figure in their history named Dr. Ambedkar. And I had thought for a while that he was kind of like a Dr. King to African Americans, but it's really more than that. He's like a sacred figure. A holy figure in many ways. And so in thinking about the Dalit people and putting their plight in the context and in contrast to the plights of other people around the world and across time starts to show an interconnectedness that I think is very important when we think about caste.
What we see of the Dalit people in the journey that I keep thinking that you took to India, but you and the film... the film crew, yeah. and cast took to India, we see them cleaning open sewers and wading through excrement, you know, with absolutely no protection whatsoever, yeah. to look after them in that situation. You actually had, I think, people from that community specifically, yeah. performing. And I'm using performing in a very loose sense there.
Yes.
Maybe you tell me what you think they're doing. Are they acting? Are they performing? What are they doing?
Yes. So that act is known as manual scavenging. This is the act of cleaning sewers without machinery, without protective gear. This is a position, a role that Dalits are regulated to and are they do. Some of them for just something to eat and a few pennies. In the film, I went to an advocacy group that actually work as advocates and activists for this community. And so the two men that you see in the film are actual manual scavengers. And they wanted to show what they do on camera in order to really amplify their plight. Certainly, I don't have them actually in a real sewer. I would never do that. But they do perform all of the ritual and the actual work in the Hollywood version of the sewer. and really to show people this happens to this day. It looks like something that's in feudal India. You know, it looks like something centuries ago. It's happening right now. I've seen it.
The other story that I thought was very telling in this respect, and in that use of non-actors, if you like, is the story of a young black boy, Al Bright, as told by his boyhood friend, but who is now an adult, telling you the story. Tell us his story and how it's told to us in the film.
Yes, well, I hope that people will go and watch the film. I don't want to spoil it, but at the towards the end of the film, you'll see the story of Al Bright. And it's not even so much the story itself, which may seem slight. It's about a boy, a black boy, who's not allowed to enter a public swimming pool because at the time in the United States and also in the UK at some points, he was seen as a contaminant. He would contaminate the water. He would pollute the water if he got in as a black child. And so you see the whole a whole sequence of events play out around that hideous notion. I think the thing in the film that is striking to people is the whole idea of memory and how memory, especially these emotionally violent memories, shape who we are. In the sequence, you see one of his white classmates, who is now an adult, tell the story of what happened to his friend Al Bright as a young boy. And you can see and feel the weight of memory, the weight of caste, the weight of the bias that we carry that has been with him all his life. And so that is a part of what we play with a lot in the films is memory. And particularly the things that affect us as children.
I have to mention Anjanou Ellis-Taylor, hugely important in how this film is realised. She is playing the part of Isabel Wilkerson, and I know you spoke to Isabel Wilkerson to get her story. Because as much as anything, the film struck me as the story of how Isabel wrote this book. That is what you are telling here. And it has to be said, Anjanou's performance, first of all, but also the personal losses that Isabel Wilkerson went through in the making and in the writing of the book are quite extraordinary. What is that mix, if you like, of fiction, fact, documentary and straightforward storytelling that you were looking for?
Yes, well, you know, I was able to speak with Isabel Wilkerson for 2 years. This is during the pandemic. Primarily, our interviews were over Zoom, hours long. We met in person a couple of times as well. And she was very gracious in telling me the story of how she wrote the book, her research, her techniques, her interviewing, you know, her time in the libraries and with archivists, but also her time with her family. She experienced great love and great loss during the time that she was writing the book. And so she was gracious and generous with her time and sharing those things with me. And I melded the stories that she told me with the actual kind of aha big moments that I had from the book, her anthropological thesis. And the film is really a braiding together of the personal stories along with the kind of scholarly pursuit of the book. And hopefully it allows people to, you read the book because you're with her as she's writing the book. So by the time you get to the end of the movie, you've written the book with her. And so you understand what caste is. And I loved the idea of doing it this way because it allowed people who would never read the book, many people won't, to understand and enter into the story through her character.
Ava, thanks so much for being with us on Arena this evening. It's a fascinating film and made me think a lot and opened up a whole new set of ideas to me.
Oh, I love that. Thank you for talking to me.
Now, over his decades-long career, the Oscar-nominated actor Viggo Mortensen has brought vigour and intensity to his roles, whether as an anarchist dad in Captain Fantastic, a chauffeur in The Green Book, or as kingly hero Aragorn in The Lord of the Rings, a job which brought him global fame. But when he's not working with directors like Peter Jackson and David Cronenberg,
Viggo Mortensen himself can be found directing, not to mention writing, producing, acting and composing all on one project. The Dead Don't Hurt is his second feature as a writer-director, and it's a western of sorts. He stars in it as Holger Olsen, a Danish veteran who has come to the United States as tensions threaten to spill over into civil war. He meets the formidable French-Canadian woman Vivienne, played by Vicky Creeps. Together, they make a life for themselves in rural Nevada, only for it to be disrupted by conflicts near and far. I spoke to Viggo Mortensen earlier today about this latest project. Before I bring you that conversation, let's hear a moment from the film when Vivian and Olsen encounter each other for the first time in San Francisco.
Olsen.
Just Olsen?
Just Olsen.
Vivian?
Just Vivian.
Vivian Le Cousy.
Oh. Enchanté. Vous êtes française?
No.
You're not American.
Yes, I am.
You don't sound like it.
And neither do you.
I know that your first feature, Viggo, was inspired by your mother falling, but it was very much, it was a parent-child, the intricacies of that relationship and a much more contemporary feel to it. Here we are now in The Dead Don't Hurt in 1860s America, frontier America, but yet your mother was a kind of an inspiration here once again.
Yeah, it's true. The first image that came to me was of this little girl that you see in the film running in a forest in the northeast of the United States, right next to, right on the Canadian border, you know, maples, red oaks, black walnuts. And that little girl who's very stubborn and very independent, with a vivid imagination, very much her own person, grows up to be a woman just like that, very free-thinking, independent woman, played by Vicky Creeps, wonderful actress, and she does a fantastic job in the part. That was the first thing that came to me. I was thinking, okay, where do we put such a woman, you know? And I thought, let's put her on the Western frontier in the 19th century, 1860s, because that's a place where she's going to face, you know, great obstacles. Mm. It's going to be a big challenge for her to be how she is in a place that's essentially lawless, dominated by a few powerful, unscrupulous men who are not averse to using violence to achieve their aims. And that'll just make it tougher for her. And that's how it ended up being a Western.
And the link to your mother there is quite interesting, I think.
Well, her personality, my mom was like Vivian, an ordinary woman, you know, by and large, you know, a woman conditioned by the times she lived in, you know, mother of three boys, housewife, but someone who was always, like Vivian, curious about other cultures, languages, people, movies, music, someone who'd like to challenge herself and did not really take no for an answer when it came to doing something she wanted to do or learning something she wanted to learn. She was like that her whole life. So it was kind of, Vivian is inspired by her.
And that wonderful independence that she has, it's played so lightly, I would have to say, by Vicky Creeps. You know, there's not an ounce, I didn't see one ounce of overacting. It was beautifully tempered in that respect. And she has to deal with some right bios, as we might say, in this part of the world, in both the setting in the period and the setting itself. And there's one Irish fella chasing her gloriously at the beginning of the film, Lewis Cartwright, played by Colin Morgan.
Yeah, Colin is great, and he did that, play that part perfectly, and it was an honor and a privilege to have him there. to play that part. He just lifted that section of the movie just by his talent, his presence, and he really came prepared. Yeah.
He does a beautiful job, as you say. But interesting for us in this part of the world is his Irish accent. And it's not just him that has the Irish accent, of course. You are playing, because you are part of this film, not just the director. We'll talk about the multi-roles in a little bit. You are playing the character of Olsen, a Danish man who is in that part of the world as well. And Vicky Creeps, the character Vivian, has this French background to her, French-Canadian background to her. I guess that's what the frontier gave you. It really was a melting pot of that nature. There are lots of other ethnicities and nationalities represented as well.
Yeah, that is true. I mean, it's true historically. And even though, I mean, yes, in other Westerns, you often see Mexicans or Irish people, Chinese, you know, or a movie, say, like Heaven's Gate, you have Eastern Europeans and Germans speaking their language and so forth. But by and large, nearly always the lead characters in Westerns are almost always Anglo-Saxon, native-born, you know, U.S. or Canada at most. And in this case, our two leads are, as you say, they don't have English as their first language. And but they are very much, you know, there's a scene in which when they meet and I hear her accent, when I first hear her, and I say, oh, well, you're French. And she says, no. I said, well, you're not American. She says, yes, I am. I say, well, you don't sound like it. And she says, well, neither do you. and that's, you know, I mean, it was as important to get the, let's say, the saddles and the lamps and the clothing and all the details correct. It was just as important to get the languages right and the cultural, racial, ethnic diversity, you know, right. And you don't often, it's not always that you really get that cross-section in Westerns. And I think it's important. You know, it's only if you're in denial or you're just ignorant that you think today or then the U.S. was, you know, America for Americans or, you know, make America great again. What does that mean? It's code for white Christians, you know, I suppose, in many quarters. And that's just not reality. It's any more than saying English for the English or France for the French. You know, it's like, what is that? It's always been a mixed bag. Unless you were a Native American indigenous person, even in a small town like our fictional town of Elk Flats, Nevada, you came from many different places and you will sound different and look different.
And you mentioned just like today, and that's what struck me most about that aspect. It allowed the film, perhaps, even though set in 1860s and on the frontier, the Western frontier, it allowed it to be a very modern film. And in particular, it allowed Vivian, the character played by Vicky Creeps, to be an incredibly modern woman. In that she's independent, she's very much got her own agency, etc. But I wondered, you know, in your researches and then looking at that period, in fact, was it women like that who survived well in that type of environment? People like that?
Yeah, I mean, there were lots of Vivians. It's just that those stories haven't been told, you know, whether at the time in newspapers or contemporary accounts, novels. The story of the Vivians of the West are few and far between because there wasn't an interest from the storytellers or the people telling those the history of that time. And then when movies started, screenplays started to be written, same thing, you know, it was like, okay, what are the men up to? Really? And the women are supportive, they're pretty, or they're vulnerable, or, you know, there have been Westerns where women have played central roles, but normally they are powerful women, unusual, extraordinary women. They're big ranches, like say Barbara Stanwyck in 40 Guns, or even in The Furies, or you know, movies like that, or Claudia Cardinale in there. She's not the central character, but she's important in one of Sergio Leone's movies. Marlene Dietrich, but they're unusual.
Yes.
You know, they're so spectacularly unique. And what's great about Vivian is it's just a woman.
Yeah.
Also, we explored something that I'd never seen and you rarely see in any genre, not just Westerns, which is when the man goes to war, we go with the man and we go to war.
Yeah.
In this case, he rides literally out of shot. We don't even pan with him as we stay with her and for quite some time. And that was something that we wanted to explore. I was curious about what happens to little girls when their fathers go to war, as we see happen with young Vivian. Or women like Vivian, what happens when their partners go off to war, or let's say their sons or brothers or what have you? What do they get up to? You know, the normal thing is to show
the guy at war.
So, yeah, you show the guy in the war and he suffers. He comes, returns battle scarred mentally, physically, whatever. He's gone through a lot and we empathize with that. And then we've almost forgotten about her. And then he comes home, and if long enough has gone by, she's maybe dead, or which is very sad for him, of course, and or maybe she's run off with another. She's married someone else. You know, too much time has passed, and that's very sad for him. Or she runs to him tearfully, beaming, and embraces him and welcomes him home tearfully. You know, and that's great for him. But what about her? What has she been up to?
And it does play. Is it you playing with the Western genre? Was that a very conscious type of approach you wanted to take?
I didn't think about. You mean about the
the overall shape of the film and all of that, and the way you're kind of pulling apart some of those ideas of the Western. That let's not go to war. Let's stay in the small town with the woman who's left behind. That type of thing.
I wasn't thinking I'm playing with something. I just was curious. You know, I thought, well, I'd like to see a story like that, and so I guess I'll write it, you know, and try to make a movie out of it. I didn't, you know, my point of departure wasn't like conceptual. It's like, oh, I'm going to make a political statement or something, or even compare it to now. I think any story where human beings really seem like human beings and have real or realistic seeming problems and obstacles and relationships, you're naturally going to compare it to your own family, even if it's set in the Middle Ages, you know. If it's done well, you know, let's say you watch Lord of the Rings, it's a fantasy. But if the people are interacting in a credible way and the emotional stakes are credible, you're going to relate it to your own life, your own struggles, or your own family, your own community, you know. And I think that happens with any movie that's a story that's more or less well told.
And that love story is so central to the film, as you say, Viggo. There were certain scenes, like beautiful where the chemistry between yourself and Vicky Creeps was so incredible. I thought, how can he step from behind the camera into that scene? And did you just have to leave Viggo director over on the seat and let Viggo actor take over when you got on set?
Well, the director's still there, and in a strange way, which sounds, you wouldn't think so, but in a way, I think I'm more efficient, more focused as an actor when I'm also directing. It is more tiring, and I prefer, to be honest, the days where I didn't have to act as well, where I was just directing, because I could just be on the set all the time. I didn't have to run off and get changed. Nobody had to come in and make sure that continuity on me, or, you know, I could relate to the actors and the crew, and just it was more relaxed and I was less tired at the end of the day. But when you're acting in a scene that you're also directing, whether it's a love scene or a dialogue scene, it doesn't matter. You don't have time to really second guess yourself. You know, if you're prepared and you know your lines, you're listening, watching everything the other actor's doing opposite you, but you're also paying attention to everything that's within the frame, what's going to be seen on screen, you know, the light, the objects, everything. And so you're present. You're doing what you should always do as an actor, which is be in the moment, moment to moment, and present, and react. I mean, the foundation of really good acting, I think, is good reacting. That's how where it starts. And so I didn't need more than one or two takes usually, because I was available to the other actor as one always should be,
And I guess when you're getting what you were getting from Vicky Creeps, it might by probably
helped
it a lot. But it makes me wonder now, is directing beginning to creep to the fore? Or it sounds as if you kind of like the dual role, in fact.
I like it. I do like it. I would, if I had my choice, and the money was available to start shooting tomorrow, I would be directing another movie now. I mean, as soon as I'm done.
And acting in it or just directing?
The next one I'm likely to do, I won't be in it, no. Mm. Yeah.
Now, it was when I was making the promo for tonight's programme, I said, you know, I'll talk to Viggo Mortensen about acting, writing and producing. And then I watched the film. Oh, that's wonderful music. Who's the composer? And I waited for the credits to roll. Composer Viggo Mortensen. Who did he get to play his music? And I go, wait for that credit to come up. Yes, Viggo Mortensen is there again, playing bass, guitar. was there another instrument in there? You weren't playing the cello.
Primarily piano.
Viggo, it's been an absolute privilege and joy to speak with you. Congratulations on the film. Long may the multitasking continue for you and multi-role playing. Thanks so much for being with us on Arena.
Thank you, Sean.
You're listening to Arena.
So many of the films of Wim Wenders are now considered classics. Films like Paris, Texas, Wings of Desire, and his documentary Buena Vista Social Club. He has long been associated with the city of Tokyo, in particular for his work there on the 1985 documentary Tokyo Ga, about the renowned Japanese filmmaker Yasujiro Ozu, whose work has been an acknowledged inspiration to Wenders. Now his latest feature, Perfect Days, sees the auteur returning to the Japanese capital to make a meditative feature film about living minimally and living in the present. It tells the story of Hirayama, a man in late middle age who, we gradually learn, has turned his back on the rat race to focus instead on the simple, everyday pleasures in life. He takes enormous care in his work as a toilet cleaner and makes the most of his downtime and indeed any moments of joy that come his way. Recently, when I spoke to Wim Wenders about Perfect Days, I began by asking him about the unusual way the film came about.
It was an invitation. It was a very nice open invitation. If I might want to come to Tokyo and to see if a number of places could inspire me. Now, I like to be inspired by places. That's the way I usually make my movies. But in this case, when I kept reading, the places were toilets. And I wasn't quite so sure if I was going to take that invitation seriously until I continued reading that these toilets were quite special and that they were made by 15 world-famous architects, of which I know two personally. And Tadao Ando was actually a good friend. So I took these toilets more seriously and realized they were pretty gems. And these architects who normally built banks and museums had built the tiniest possible units, which was a public toilet. So I was intrigued and I went the next possible time, which was a couple of months later, looked at the toilets, liked them, but realized it was maybe not the greatest thing one could do at that moment in Tokyo to make documentary about these toilets. Somehow behind the whole idea, there was something bigger hidden and there was something more important to do. It was right after the pandemic. The Japanese people had come out after the longest lockdown and they came back and took possession of the city in such a peaceful, beautiful, civilized way, respectful of each other and of the places. And the opposite had happened in my own town and in many places where I'd been after the pandemic. The pandemic had a huge victim in most places, which was the sense of the common good, and not so in Japan. On the opposite, it seemed like this sense, the civic sense, had even survived better. And I loved that. And I felt the urge to make a movie about something that I had sensed all during the pandemic. I had sensed we should all sort of, humanity should start living after different afterwards. We should all learn from it. And it didn't happen. Actually, the opposite was the place. Life was more reckless than before.
Yeah.
And in Tokyo, I saw an alternative. And I thought, well, if I tell a story of a caretaker of these toilets, so they appear and they are beautiful places. And I love these little parks. And I love Tokyo in the first place. And then I can do something that's really worth the time instead of making four documentaries that in the end only architectural aficionados would see. So as I was invited, I told them what I was inspired to and thinking I would talk me out of the job. But instead they said, oh, well, that's interesting. Do you think you can actually do it? And I said, yes, all I need is a script and a good actor. And that became the beginning of Perfect Days.
I must say, as you describe it there, my reaction when I heard Wim Wenders is making a film that's about toilets, I did probably have a reaction to something the same as your own. How's he going to do that? And what you give us is this extraordinary story, because it is a fiction, but a fiction based in and around the importance of, you know, those public toilets in terms of public service, in terms of how we are part of a community. But around this man, this character, Hirayami, played by Koji Yakusho, he's an extraordinary character. And to some extent, yes, it could have been a documentary. There is a kind of documentary feel to it, which is hardly surprising in terms of your own filmmaking. We sit with him in his van as he travels to the various toilets that he cleans, and we watch him cleaning those toilets, which on the surface of it sounds like a pretty dull story. How slowly or in what way from those very mundane, everyday, repeated actions, when did the story start to unfold out into something much bigger?
It started, I think, out of the character. It started out of his dedication, out of the self-esteem that he gets out of doing something as good as possible. He's not depending on the approval of others. He's just depending on his own self-respect. And he gets it out of his work, like a good craftsman gets his self-respect out of dedicating all his efforts each time in the same object, may it be clay or wood, and he creates something with his hands and does it as good as he can. And these craftsmen in Japan are very highly regarded. They're almost at the top of the social ladder. They're national monuments. And here in our civilization, in Europe and in America, craftsmen are rather on the lower level of social acceptance. So in Japan it's different, and they have this respect for things that are done beautifully and with care and with love. And so he goes about his work, and he has this other idea that he realized it somewhere in the past of his life, that if you have too much or if you have it all, you don't have nothing. And if you have just what you need, you might have everything. And he realized that there was a certain bliss in reducing your life to what you need, and he managed that. I have to tell you, before I made this movie, I met a number of young people in New York, also in Berlin, other cities. They are part of a movement, and the movement is, can you live with as much stuff that fits into a suitcase? And if you're not, then you're not part of the club. And all these young people who are into minimalism and to reduction, they are all cool, calm, and collected. And there is a light in their eyes, and they know what they're living for. And all their friends who have everything and who, I don't know, who live in abundance, are still lacking a lot. So I realized these people had a great idea. And I've tried to put this idea also into our man Hirayama's life. He just has what he needs. He's happy to read his book in the evening, but he only reads one. And when he's finished, he goes and buys one new one. He doesn't go buy a stack. He buys one next book. And it's, of course, a used book, because The book is still the same if somebody else read it or not. And he takes pictures with his camera, but he only has one film of 20 exposures, and he gives it to be developed on the weekend, and he buys one more film.
Yeah.
And that is philosophy. You only need little to do everything you want. And he bought a cassette recorder from his youth and found his old cassettes and realized this was the only music he ever cared for. So he doesn't need more.
It couldn't have been made anywhere but Japan, I'm guessing, Vim. They have lessons to teach us.
Thank you. They absolutely have. And I can't wait to be back. And I thank you for our talk, Sean. Sean rocks, it says. Is it true?
You might have to ask others that. If about the statement, the name is true. The statement, that is for others to judge.
Okay, Sean, you rock. I wish you the very best.
You too, Vim. Thanks very much for a lovely movie. Yeah.
Thanks.
Just a perfect day. Drink sangria in the park. And then later, when it gets dark, we go home. Just a perfect day. Feed animals in the zoo. Then later, a movie too, and then home.
And that was the one and only Lou Reed ending tonight's Arena with the song that gives Wim Wenders' film Perfect Day its title.